This is the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Laymiller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Some of the most common sex questions I've received from listeners and readers over the years include, am I having enough sex? And am I masturbating too much? People seem to be very interested in how their sex life compares to other people's sex lives. We often engage in these social comparisons in order to determine whether we're normal or not. But the truth of the matter is that these comparisons can lead us astray because normal doesn't mean just one thing when it comes to sex. The normal range is a very wide one. So in today's show, we're going to dive into some of the diversity and variability that exists in sexual behavior. We're going to look at frequency ranges for both masturbation and partnered sex. We're also going to explore how many adults say they've never engaged in these behaviors, why sexual frequency seems to be decreasing all around the world, and how factors like age and relationship status influence sexual frequency. My guest today is Tina Fetner, a professor of sociology at McMaster University. She is the author of the new book, Sex in Canada, The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North. She is also the former president of the Canadian Sociological Association. This is going to be a fascinating conversation. Stick around, and we're going to jump in right after the break. MailMyMeds is an online service that allows Americans to access prescription and affordable medication delivery services. They allow men experiencing ED to be reviewed for erectile dysfunction medication prescriptions. You can complete your online prescription questionnaire in as little as 3 minutes and get started today. You'll get reviewed by one of their partnering U.S. board-certified physicians and find out if your prescription has been approved in as little as 1 hour. If approved, prescriptions are good for 1 year of refills, and you can get generic Viagra and Cialis starting at $2 per pill. All medications are dispensed from USA pharmacies, and you'll receive your order in 3 to 5 business days, shipped straight to you in discreet packaging. MailMyMeds offers low pricing and unmatched convenience, and the whole process can be done from the comfort of your own home. To learn more or get started today, visit MailMyMeds.com. That's MailMyMeds.com. If you're a fan of this show, then I know you're hungry for sexuality knowledge. But if you're also looking to find a community of like-minded, sex-positive professionals, check out the Sexual Health Alliance. SHA connects you with world-class experts and an active group of passionate, fun, and welcoming students. SHA is at the forefront of sexuality education and hosts monthly live events, both online and in person, with students from all over the world and from all types of backgrounds. They come together to learn, travel, connect, and sometimes form friendships. So, podcast fans, continue advancing your sexuality knowledge, have fun, and meet fantastic people in the process at Sexual Health Alliance. You can find their upcoming events and online certification programs at sexualhealthalliance.com. Hi, Tina, and welcome to the Sex and Psychology Podcast.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. So you recently completed a large-scale study of the sexual attitudes and behaviors of Canadian adults and then published the results in a book titled Sex in Canada. So what's the brief story behind this project? Why was it important to you to take a peek at what Canadians are doing between the sheets?
Well, I'm a sociologist of sexualities, and so a lot of what I do, especially in the classroom when I'm teaching young people how to understand the social organization of sexuality, that is the way that social forces influence our sexual behaviors, mostly I do that with data from the United States, right? Because the U.S. has been collecting data on sexual attitudes and behaviors since 1992, mostly through the Kinsey Institute, which was established from research on sexualities back in the 1950s. And so we know a lot about American adults' sexual behavior, but the kinds of places that collect data in Canada, especially Statistics Canada and other scholars and researchers, have really mostly stayed away from a general survey of sexual behavior to this point.
Now, that's interesting because I know way more sex researchers in Canada than I do in the US. And in fact, I know some sex researchers who have fled from the US to Canada because it seems to be a more favorable place to do sex research. So it's interesting that we would know more about American sexual practices than we would about Canadian sexual practices if we have so many sex researchers in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's maybe ironic. That's also my sense, is that we have a lot of really, really good sex research happening here. But it is partly because of the funding structures in Canada are really oriented toward health research and also toward like solving social problems. And so a very practical-minded kind of approach to funding research, which is great, and that research is really good. But the kind of just generalist, well, what do we do and how do we do it? It isn't the kind of thing that has risen to anyone's interest until now.
Right. Now, that leads nicely into my next question. You know, I want you to tell us a little bit more about Canadians' sexual attitudes. And I say this because there are a lot of people here in the US, particularly on the political left, who think of Canada as being kind of this ultra-liberal, sex-positive utopia. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard liberals here say things like, I'm moving to Canada, in response to some very conservative legislation. And while Canada is indeed more sexually liberal in a lot of ways, the people there aren't a monolith, and Canadian sexual attitudes are probably a bit more varied and diverse than people might think. So tell us a little bit about that. What does the sexual landscape really look like up north?
Oh, this is such an interesting question to me, because I think that the way that I characterize it in the book is that we exactly have moved from a monoculture in, like, say, the 1950s is the great stereotype of, like, everybody is heterosexual. They're all supposed to get married. They're all supposed to have two kids. And this is the way that we regulate our sexuality. You have no sex outside the bounds of marriage, and you really orient your sex toward reproduction. Even though it was never 100% like that ever, you know, the culture dictated that there was one set of rules and that we were all supposed to follow them, and that anybody who didn't follow them was somehow immoral or bad or wrong. And so when you move through history, through the 1960s and 70s, through the sexual revolution, Canada diverges from the US, even though culturally we were going through these same touch points, right? Canada and the US had the very same sexual revolution. But in the US, where these cultural changes were happening, in Canada, they were also accompanied by some really important policy changes. So 1969 in Canada, it was not just the summer of love, but it was also the summer of no-fault divorce policy. It was the summer of decriminalizing same-sex sexual activity, at least on the books, if not in practice by policing. And Canadians are very proud, and everybody remembers the quote by the minister that became the prime minister, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, that the state has no place in the bedrooms of Canadian people. And so we have this kind of sensibility of, like, okay, well, we liberalized much earlier than the US. And the difference, I think, is that we liberalized our policies and our attitudes. And, you know, that wasn't the end of the story. We kept going. But I think we do now. I do characterize Canadian sexual culture as multicultural. Right? There are different pockets of the culture that have kind of different rules and collective understandings about how to organize our sexuality. So, you know, that might be the lesbian and gay community, and especially gay men have created sort of more open understandings of sexual rules than relative to heterosexuals, but also kind of our sexual cultures, you know, map on in different ways, like our Francophone culture. The data in my book show is slightly more open, more active, more appreciative of a wider array of sexual activities than Anglophone, English-speaking culture. And so we have differences that way.
Yeah. So you definitely liberalized a lot sooner in many ways when it comes to sexual attitudes, behaviors, policies. But yeah, it's very much a multicultural society. Attitudes are very diverse, and it depends like what part of Canada you're in terms of what the norms might be. You know, I talk about this a lot when I teach my study abroad courses in the Netherlands. You know, people also talk about the Netherlands as being kind of this sexual utopia, but, you know, they have a Bible Belt in the Netherlands, and not everybody has these very liberal, open, positive attitudes toward sexuality. So, you know, Canada, the US, the Netherlands, these are all big countries. They're very diverse in people's attitudes. Nobody's a monolith when it comes to how they view this stuff.
That's right. That's right. And if you think about all of the different pockets of culture, all of the ethnic communities, religious communities, all of the kind of ways that people have diverse opinions. And really, one of the characteristics of Canadian culture to manage all the vast differences of people here is there are a lot of things we just don't talk about. We make nice by being open and understanding and tolerant, but also we're kind of quiet about controversial topics. And so when it comes to sexuality, sometimes that means that we're not necessarily very comfortable talking about sex and sexuality. It's not necessarily a bad thing because it does kind of allow for lots of differences of opinions to flourish, but it also means that we're maybe a little bit shy.
Yeah. You know, and that's true. So there can be some sexual shame, some repression, some discomfort around sex, no matter where you go in the world. Nobody has a sexual utopia yet, but once we find it, we're all going to move there. So, okay, let's talk about how much sex people are having. I think this is a great topic for the show because one of the most common sexual concerns I hear from people is whether they're having enough sex or whether they're masturbating too much. You know, people are very concerned about whether they're normal when it comes to their sex lives. So let's start with masturbation. In your work, what percentage of adults at least sometimes engage in masturbation? And how many of them say that they've just never done it at all?
Yeah, this is such an interesting topic, and it's one I love to talk about with my students in class because, I'll present the data to you. So when you ask a representative sample of all Canadian adults of all ages over 18, whether they've masturbated in the past month, what I learned is that 55% of Canadians said yes. So most Canadians, but barely more than half, right? And so when I tell my traditionally aged university students this, my 18 to 21-year-olds, they're like, liars. Everybody's masturbating every day. What are you talking about? And I was like, well, is your grandma masturbating every day? And they're like, ew, how could you say that? And there's a really important age, really a generational difference in people's relationship with masturbation. And so this is one of the things where I use this as a way to demonstrate that social forces influence our most personal, private choices about our own sexuality, right? Because for my young university age adults, they came of age in a time when there were very few prohibitions against masturbation, when pornography is easy to access and almost ubiquitous, when that we have a more public discourse around masturbation. But the kind of culture that a couple generations earlier grew up in, the 60s and 70s, 80s and 90s, the folks who are that age now grew up in a time when religion was a lot stronger, when people of the most popular religions were getting very negative messages about masturbation and really any non-procreative sexuality. So to answer your question about never masturbating, 14% of Canadians said that they never masturbated in their lives. And there's a big age difference. The majority of them are either, you know, very old or the oldest, you know, senior citizens in the, or very young. And so they haven't really had a lot of time, right? And so like the 18 to 20s, maybe they said they never masturbated, but older folks really had more restrictions, more social norms and more social consequences for masturbation than the rest of us. And it shows in their choices.
Yeah. Such interesting findings. Now for people who masturbate What kind of frequency do they do it with? I don't know if you asked about how often people are doing it, but what do we know about the range that we're talking about when it comes to, for those who engage in self-pleasure, how often are they doing it?
Yeah, we didn't get any more fine-grained than within the last month, right? We didn't ask if it was daily or more often than that. And so I don't have the answer to that question. But, you know, the question I would bounce back to you is, who cares? Like if we know that there's social influence of masturbation, but does it really matter if you're masturbating weekly or daily? Like unless you're injuring yourself, like, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, I'm a sociologist, but like, you know, from my perspective, it's like, well, whatever works for you is the way that it should do. But if you're worried about what the averages are, most people are masturbating fairly regularly, more men than women. Slightly under half of women said they masturbated in the last month, and 64% of men said they masturbated in the last month. And so averages out to just more than half.
So for people who might be curious about the numbers, we do have the numbers from the US because we have asked about that here. So if you look at the National Survey of Sexual Health and Behavior, what that study finds is that most men are doing it at least once a week or more. And by contrast, most women are doing it once a week or less. So as you mentioned, there is a pretty sizable gender difference when it comes to frequency of masturbation. But I think you're so right that we shouldn't get so hung up on the numbers. You know, I'm a social psychologist. I know people are always engaging in social comparison. They're looking to what other people are doing as a way of judging or determining whether they themselves are normal. And you know what? You can masturbate every day or most days of the week, and that can be perfectly normal. Or you can do it once or twice a month or just a few times a year, and that can be normal too. You know, don't get too hung up on the frequency, because what matters is, are you doing it at a frequency that you are happy with? Are you enjoying the time that you spend on self-pleasure? Like, those are the key metrics, not how many times a week you're doing it. And if you're worried that you're doing it too much, the question to ask yourself is this making me late for work? Am I unable to carry out my tasks of daily living because I'm masturbating so much? You know, if so, then, you know, that might be an issue where you might want to talk to a sex therapist, but otherwise, probably not something to be too worried about.
Mm-hmm. The way that I put it in my book is that I say, I can tell you what's average, but not what's normal.
Yeah, that's another good way to think of it. When it comes to spending money on things you buy for your household, what do you like to save money on? And what do you like to splurge on? And does your partner feel the same or different? Or maybe you don't know because you've never really talked about it. My partner and I just completed a game that prompted us to discuss our spending preferences on Paired, which is a relationship app for couples. This is a topic we hadn't really talked that much about before, and it was eye-opening. While we agreed on most things, it was useful to find the areas where we didn't agree so that we could talk about it and find a compromise so that it doesn't become an issue down the line. That's one of the things I love about this app. It encourages us to talk about things before they become problems. It's also just a great way to stay connected and to have deeper conversations. There are daily questions, quizzes, games, exercises, and more. It's a great way to learn new things about your partner, and it's simple and easy to use. All you do is download the app and pair your accounts, and that's it. The activities are fun, and sometimes they're kind of funny. Whether you're just a few dates in or you've been together a long time, it's time to lighten the mood and have fun with your partner by using Paired. Head over to paired.com/Justin to get a 7-day free trial and 25% if you sign up for a subscription. Just go to paired.com/Justin to sign up today. Connect with your partner every day using Paired. A happier relationship starts here. So let's talk about partnered sex. So in your work, how many people said that they had had sex in the past year and how many did not? And further, I know I'm like throwing a bunch of questions at you all at once. I want to know how many of those adults who weren't sexually active in the past year have just never had sex before?
Okay. So when you ask people if they've had partnered sex in the past, say, year, 70% of Canadians said that they had. And when I tell folks this, sometimes they're surprised that number seems low, right? It seems like everybody is having sex every year, and that, you know, what's happening with the other 30% of the people. And the way that I like to think of it is like, well, if you think about your entire adult lifetime, there surely are going to be some years where you don't have partnered sex, where your health is poor or where your partnership dissolves or just something is going on. And so it shouldn't be surprising that there are years where people don't have sex. Among that group who didn't have sex in the past year, we see that it was about 20% who had never had sex yet, just over 20%. When you ask about people who had never had sex, it was 11% of the whole sample who said that they hadn't had sex or would, in our older terminology, be classified as a virgin, right? And so we asked this 11% a few questions to dive into their reasons behind why they had never had sex. We were very curious about the concept of virginity and whether it was still meaningful. My sense culturally is that the concept of being a virgin has changed dramatically in the last, you know, half a century or so, from being a highly prized kind of status that you sought to maintain to now being kind of a stigma that young people are worried about getting labeled with and are trying to, you know, have partnered sexual activities so that they can rid themselves of the status of virginity. And so I was curious to see what was going on there. And so, you know, we had a check all that apply kind of questions of like, what were your reasons were? And we had a really wide variety of people saying that they were waiting till they found somebody that they were really comfortable with, to reflections on their own personality, like, I'm very shy, so that's getting in the way of my partnered sex. And then other kinds of reasons that were seemed more directed by social norms, right? Like, I'm waiting till I get married, or I'm waiting till I'm in love. That seemed more reminiscent of a kind of religious or a kind of cultural prohibition against sex before marriage. And so we see a really interesting mix.
Yeah, definitely an interesting mix. And I think a lot of people will be surprised by some of those numbers, that a third of adults say that they did not have sex in the last year, and that about 1 in 10 adults have never had sex before. You know, it fits with a growing narrative we're seeing in the research, not just from Canada, but from the US and elsewhere around the world, that people seem to be having less sex than they used to before, and that we've got a growing number of adults who just either aren't having it at all, or they're having it with much less frequency. And this is also true when you look at average sexual frequency, like how much sex are people having. If we look at some US data, if we go back to the National Survey of Sexual Health and Behavior, if you look at the wave of data from about 2009, Americans reported having sex about 63 times per year, so more than once per week. But if you look at data from a decade later, they're reporting that they're having sex about 47 times a year, so now it's less than once per week. And we're seeing this for singles, for people in relationships, like, just the numbers across the board seem to show this decline in sexual frequency. So as a sexuality researcher, I'm curious for your take on why people seem to be having less sex and why we have this growing population of adults who just aren't sexually active.
This is an excellent question. All I can do is speculate. I've seen these data as well. It's fascinating to me. What I would do is tie it to other similar kinds of trends, right? And so I'm a middle-aged woman. I've spent my whole decade after decade going through moral panic about youth sexuality after moral panic about youth sexuality. It's just one after the other of the kids are having too much sex, the teens are getting too pregnant, they're having the wrong kind of sex. You know, there's like an anal sex moral panic that we went through. And now—
Everything's a panic.
Everything is wrong. The kids are always doing it wrong. It's always a worry. And now we see that, you know, young people, their age of first sexual activity, a partnered activity, is older on average, slightly older. They're having less sex, and just all the things that you said. And the other social data is going in a similar direction. So young people are doing less petty crime. They're committing fewer acts of violence. And, you know, getting into trouble less than my generation, less than your generation. And we don't really have a cultural narrative to explain that. It doesn't fit what we want to say about young people, which is they should be more like us. And really, they're making choices that are healthier than the choices that we made at their age. And so I don't know if the sexual frequency is similarly a kind of a healthy choice that they're making, but what seems to be driving all of those other social trends is just that there are kind of better things for them to be doing. And the crime data has looked at this very closely and found that the kinds of young people that did crimes are now doing more video games, right? And so the actual time spent playing video games is time taken away from, you know, juvenile delinquency, basically. And I have to wonder, though I don't have the answer to this question, I have to wonder if it isn't just the same explanation about partnered sexual activity. People are, you know, have lots of things to fill their time. They have lots of different kinds of entertainment, and partnered sexual activity is in that mix. You know, it's not going anywhere. It's still really good and enjoyable, and people want to do it. But, you know, it's got to take its place with all the other things we have to do.
And, you know, I think there's certainly some truth to what you're saying about how we have more ways to occupy our time, and that includes spending a lot more time on our devices. You know, that could be playing games or watching TV or movies or spending time on social media. But the more of that time that we're spending on our devices, we're not spending in person with other people. And so that creates fewer opportunities for sexual contact. So, you know, the balance of our life has certainly shifted from fewer in-person interactions to more digital interactions. And I think that that has also led kind of the nature of the way that we connect with other people sexually to shift as well, because we're seeing a rise in sexual behaviors occurring online, right? So maybe we're having more digital sex, but less in-person sex. So, you know, part of it is sort of like that shift in terms of how we're spending our time. But I think another big part of the story, especially for younger adults, is that they live in this era of heightened surveillance and supervision. You know, it's totally different from when I was a teenager. I had a lot more freedom than kids today do to leave my home, to go out, to do things, to make my own choices, to hang out with who I wanted to. And I had more opportunities to get into trouble. And I did get into trouble, right? Because there was somewhat less of that kind of supervision. But now that everybody has the doorbell cams and like tracking devices on their kids' phones and all these other things, and they know where their kids are at all times, like that helicopter parenting, I think also creates a lot fewer opportunities for sexual behavior as well. So it's just it's a totally different world, especially for today's youth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my data are on adults, and so the youngest is 18, but I think 100%, even university students are much more closely tied to their parents, even when they live away from home. It's just a different sensibility, and I want to refrain from characterizing it as a problem necessarily until we see that it is really a problem, because it seems to me like, is it terrible that they have great relationships with their parents in a way that I, you know, that somebody my age, that would have been odd or unusual? I'm like, oh, that seems okay. But if it's preventing them from accessing their joy and finding their way to pleasure, then that's the time I think we need to worry about it.
You know, I'd like to be agnostic on this like you, or to be optimistic and to say, you know, maybe it's not a bad thing that they're having less sex. But my like persistent nagging worry is that the longer that teens and young adults delay sexual activity and relationship formation, the fewer opportunities they have to really practice that before they get into adulthood and, you know, everything else that goes along with that. And I think the longer you delay it, and when you don't really have that practice, it just makes it an even more high stakes kind of thing. And then when you go to try and cultivate and form relationships, it's only going to be harder. You know, I kind of like to think of that time in high school and college as being when you're testing a lot of the waters and you're kind of figuring out the basics of how do relationships work sexually and romantically. And if I didn't have that experience and I waited until adulthood, I shudder to think like how petrified I would have been, you know, not knowing anything about all of that. So that's just where my concern is like the lack of experience. What is the long-term implications of that? And we won't know till later. Maybe you're right. Maybe I should be agnostic, but I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I certainly wouldn't argue it. But what I would point out is that there's a deep demographic shift in how long we're waiting until we do settle down into our partnerships. And that this is quite new. If you go back 60 years, like we were getting married in our early 20s. And now I think that the age of first marriage is up around 29. For average, right? And so there's this whole new phase of life of young adulthood, extended singledom, that is kind of dedicated toward all the kind of experimentation and trying out relationships or failing and or being single or whatever. And, you know, people are really not settling down until much older than they were in the past. So I think that young people feel that they have more time to sort it all out.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they do. So, all right. I have one more question for you on sexual frequency, which is about some of the factors that affect how often or how sexually active people are. And I think age and relationship status are a couple of big ones. So one of the popular stereotypes is that older adults just stop having sex. They just don't do it. You know, it goes back to what you were saying toward the top of the show about how if people think about their parents or their grandparents having sex, like it, the idea of that grosses them out. They just don't like to think about people past a certain age still being sexually active. One of the other big stereotypes is that, you know, people who are single are having like all the sex, right? Because they're going out and they got all these opportunities and there's hookup culture and all these other sorts of things. But what's the truth there? You know, how are age and relationship status actually linked to sexual frequency?
Well, I think it's probably related to, once again, to this idea that of reproductive sexuality, that that's the good sexuality. And we have this kind of sensibility that we should be really grossed out at senior citizens having active or joyful sexual lives. But they're not grossed out by it. They're not worried to talk about it. By the time you reach your senior years, you know yourself, you've made all your mistakes, and you know you're much more likely to know what you want. And so, I mean, sexual frequency does go down over the life course. And so older adults don't have sex as frequently as people in their young adulthood to middle age years. But one of the things that was really interesting that doesn't disappear. So even our oldest respondents had active sex lives. And so people do continue to have sex well into their senior years. We also asked people about if they were happy about their sex lives, if they were satisfied with their sex lives. And the proportion of people who were satisfied with their sex lives grew over the life course. And so the 70 plus, the oldest group that we had the were the most likely to say that they were happy with their sex lives. And so I thought one of the things that was really fun to see was the way that even when the kind of quantity of sex that you had went down as you got older, it seemed that your perceptions of your sex life improved over time. So your quality improved. So I'd love to see that. That was great.
Yeah. And speaking of that, one other myth I mentioned, you know, this idea that singles are the most sexually active, I think your data dispel that as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we have that, you know, this is, I think, a media-based myth, right? Where all of the good shows are showing us all the ways that young single people are really active sexually, and where the sort of married couples that we see on TV or whatever are kind of in sexless, like boring relationships. And the data showed quite the opposite. Married people were more like, had more frequent sexual encounters than single people. And so then once you know that, then you tell a different story and it starts to make a lot of sense that somebody who has a sexual partner living under the same roof as them is going to have sex more often than somebody that has to go out on the town and meet somebody and make a connection and have the opportunity to have a sexual encounter. And so it's one of those things where it seems obvious after you learn it.
Yeah. And also another one of those cases where, again, there's a lot of dramatic individual variability. There's no such thing as normal when it comes to all of this. There are some singles who have way more sex than married people. There are some married people who are in sexless marriages. You know, it's all a spectrum. People are all over the map when it comes to their sex lives. But thanks for sharing this with us, Tina. And I look forward to continuing our conversation in the next episode, where we're going to dive into commitment, casual sex, and cheating. Thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Tina. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work and get a copy of your new book?
You can get it at any massive online bookstore or your local independently owned bookstore. It's is a labor of love. I really am delighted to share it with the world. It's called Sex in Canada, The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North.
Love it. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate having you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.